Hello and welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I am your host of this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CRFC, so thank you to both of them. Now, if you have missed an episode of the show on air at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or the CFRC podcast. Many great options to learn about what our awesome grad students and postdoctoral fellows are doing here on campus. Today, I would like to introduce you to a group of graduate students who are also working at the Center for Teaching and Learning as Educational Development Assistants. They are Kim Hill Tout, a PhD student in Geography and Planning, Paul Akamoje, a PhD student in Education, and Hemetala Uda, a PhD student in Computing. Welcome to Grad Chat, everyone.
Thank you.
So thank you all for coming on the show. Today, we're going to focus a little bit on the opportunities grad students have available to them during their studies. The Center for Teaching and Learning is, of course, integral to Queen's pedagogy in various ways. So Paul, can you tell me what does the Center for Teaching and Learning offer in the way of resources for graduate students?
Thank you so much for having us on the show. I personally am very excited to be here to share what we do at the CTL as Educational Development Associates with my colleagues Kim and Heba. The CTL offers a plethora of resources to graduate students. Very many of these resources are available for all graduate students and postdocs. For example, we have modules that graduate students can access, and these modules help them to develop and build capacity for their work as teachers or as to when they need tutorials or when they are, you know, teaching firms. We have other resources such as, for example, Consul. Grad students can always just work with CTL or even send an email to CTL to request Consul for teaching dossier, for teaching statement, for teaching philosophy. And this is an integral part of grad studies, because oftentimes when we see grad students reaching their third year, their fourth year, and they're running off their program, they begin to really palpitate. They begin to project about what's the job market like. The CTL is well positioned to support them in this process, because we often feel that we do not support grad students only when they are here at Queen's, but as they also leave in Queen's to seek tenure track positions. So we do teaching dossier consultations to support them. And some even go to the extent of asking the CTL to help them, you know, rework or rewrite their CVs and whatnot. So these things also come and they will do that. We also have what we call the teaching observation. Teaching fellows and TAs who are teaching at Queen's can also come to the CTL or request that members with EDA team come to their class to sit in and observe their teaching. And they will give feedback. We give written feedback, and then we also give verbal feedback, sometimes informal feedback about how their teaching was and what they can do to improve and what they can improve on, and, you know, some of these things that they need to pay attention to. And these are some things that we do at the CTL, and I'm so sure my colleagues can chime in and mention one or two of them.
Well, that sounds incredibly helpful, like a very wide variety of supports for people beginning their teaching journeys all the way to graduate students looking at the next steps of their journeys as educators and as researchers. Thank you for that. That's incredible. And you mentioned modules. Are those available online at any time to graduate students?
Yes, these modules are, we have seven specific PTL modules that are available and accessible. And grad students can complete these modules. And then also there are tasks that they also have to complete if they have to finish a module. And then they return to us, we give feedback, we grade, not grade in that sense, but we give them feedback. And then oftentimes we ask them to, if they would like to share their revision or the rework submissions. And then we work with them, we partner with them to complete these modules oftentimes. Yes, they are very much accessible. And they are
online. Oh, that sounds wonderful. So a host of, sounds like you've got a host of synchronous and asynchronous opportunities for people to get support on their teaching and to really, sounds like you really walk beside them as they develop themselves as educators.
Yeah, that's correct.
Oh, thank you. So next, I'd like to ask Hebatella, can you tell us a little bit more about the Educational Development Assistant Program in particular? So this is one of those resources that Paul highlighted. What does it mean to be an EDA?
Wow, that's an interesting question, because you reminded me with the reason why I joined CTL as the Educational Development Associate. So I would say there were like multiple challenges that I found that face graduate students and postdoc, like even to navigate the transition from being a student to stepping into a teaching role, often without like formal training. And there is like this unspoken pressure to just know how to teach effectively or manage a classroom or design assessments, and that can be overwhelming. And I found that if I can facilitate a room for the graduate students and postdocs and teaching fellows to tackle this challenge, that would be useful. Also, I found that there was another key challenge in terms of balancing multiple identities, even if you are a researcher, teacher, even like teaching assistant or teaching fellow, learner, and in many cases, of course, caregiver or international student. So that balancing act can make it hard to prioritize like the teaching development. And I found that Center of Teaching and Learning through the EDA team is trying to recognize these challenges and work to create like accessible and supportive space. So that was like the motive behind like joining and be one of like the EDA team members.
So it sounds like the hidden curriculum of teaching almost, which is kind of an oxymoron, right? We have a hidden curriculum of curriculum, and being an EDA helps you help others discover what that means to be a teacher and all of those kind of things that you might not have considered before as a student or a learner, but now that you have to consider as an instructor.
Exactly. And also, I would like to add to what Paul said. Beside that, we are providing like teaching development program, and we offer like micro teaching sessions, consultations, and workshop events, of course. Actually, more importantly, that we are trying to foster a sense of community. So we want like graduate educators to feel like they are not alone in their journey. This journey, so that their teaching identity matters just as much as their research, and that they belong to this academic space.
Well, it sounds like incredibly important and helpful work to create a space for graduate students and postdocs to come together to learn as teachers and to teach learners, which I know sounds sounds a little circular, but I think education often is circular, but that's my personal opinion on how teaching and learning goes. Kim, how closely do you work with the educational developer at the CTL? Because I know there are staff as well. In addition to student staff, there's also full-time staff. So how closely do you work with the educational developer?
I mean, that's a great question. So it kind of, you know, stems from, or it pivots off the other questions. And my role specifically, like I'm lead EDA, but maybe by the time this airs, Hebatella and Paul will be lead EDAs coming this summer and then into the new academic term. So I'll be transitioning out. But as lead EDA, I work with Paul and Hebatella, and I was charged with hiring them and training them and all that stuff. But we have like a full-time staff. So Carolyn is in charge of like the EDA team, and we work closely with Carolyn. So we meet once a week with her, and we go over different tasks that are set out, things that come, like they field through Caitlin at the CTL or through Carolyn or through me. So different people will get requests, or Yasmin gets a lot of like personal requests for stuff like anti-racism. That's her portfolio at the CTL. And we collaborate on workshops, sometimes new workshops, sometimes sort of old ones that we tweak for different departments. Sociology requested one over the year for anti-racism training, so we developed a new workshop for them. And often, you know, the staff will include us or ask us to collaborate on projects with them. We do a lot of resource developing for different departments, like academic departments, but also different central units in Queens. So we're working on like a resource about accommodations with like a teaching and learning focus. So how do TAs manage accommodations? Like what is your responsibility? And it's this joint partnership with like the HREO and student wellness, and thinking through these problems that the like TAs and TFs or adjuncts will have and that they'll encounter. And so there's a lot. There's like a lot that we collaborate on, that we work with different people, and we'll be on different projects or on together projects. And yeah, so there's a lot of work. That's kind of like the short answer to your question. It's hard to describe like what does like one day look like. And that was a question that Paul and Hebatella asked when we're doing interviews way back when, and it was like, what does a typical day look like? And you know, Carol and I, who are trying to respond to this, we're like, well, it can look quite different. Like every week looks different. Every month looks different. And it depends the needs of the university. And it depends the needs of the students. And yeah, so.
Well, it sounds like you're very responsive though, which is, I'm sure, much appreciated by all the different partners that you work with on campus. It sounds like you have a baseline of support that you provide, but then the rest of your support is developed in collaboration, as you like, with other students, with other staff, with units, to meet the needs of what teachers and learners are seeing across campus. Well, it sounds like we could all use that type of model in our work, I think, a little bit more, that type of responsive, collaborative approach.
A little bit of winging it, a little bit of flexibility.
Well, things change so much these days, so I think that flexibility is quite helpful in responding quickly to how, especially education is changing across the local, national, international kind of landscape as we go. And this kind of transitions into a question that I wanted to ask Paul, but what are some of the key challenges that graduate students and postdocs face as educators that you're seeing right now? And what are some of the things that the CTL is doing to help address these challenges?
That's a good question. And when I say that's a good question, I don't mean in the Canadian way. One of the major challenges that I think the grad students and postdocs have at Queen's is the pedagogical identity, the teaching identity. Oftentimes when we go out for workshops, we often hear grad students who are TAing, or even those also about to take a teaching fellowship position, or even postdocs saying, I'm not a teacher, I trained as an engineer, or somebody say I trained as a public health expert, but now I have to be in class to teach. And they continue to struggle with this identity. And one thing that we often emphasize at the CTL is to say, the day you walk into your grad school program, that day you become a teacher. Whether you recognize it or not, for the 4 years or the 2 years or the 6 years, whatever number of years you're going to spend doing this grad studies or this grad program, you have to build that teacher identity. So that's one major problem that I have noticed the grad students and postdocs deal with. And at the CTA, what we often do through a variety of workshops is to help build that teacher identity. I totally get it. For somebody like me, who has been in the education faculty for over a decade, almost two decades now. One thing that often, you know, occurs to me is that it is a complex journey and it is a complex profession. So I understand when somebody who had never been a teacher before, who had never been in the classroom before, I understand when they are asked to go to the classroom and TA or teach or do a tutorial or whatnot. It's even worse when they are told to develop curriculum. Sometimes as a grad student, you are handed over a course to teach, or when you apply for a course, you apply with the euphoria, I can do it. And then when you are given the contract, you are like, okay, so where do I start from? You know, that confusion is often there. Even for those of us, you know, who have been teaching for a number of years, and for those of us who work with the CTL, who have gained those experiences working with colleagues, we have that dilemma as well. We have that confusion. So much less of somebody who has never really been a teacher. So oftentimes when we ask students to submit to the PUTL modules, you know, for some of those modules, I often come across some people say, well, I've never taught in a class, so this question doesn't apply to me. Because oftentimes, one of the reflection questions that we ask them is, think about the time you were in class, or think about a class that you have had and how you navigated X, Y, and Z situation. And then the feedback comes like, well, I've really never been in a class, and I don't know what it is like to be in a class. So these are like people who are coming to first year, second year, and they've not had their own class to teach. So that is one major area of struggle, that teacher identity. The identity is tied to the pedagogical competence. It's often because they don't feel that they have that pedagogy, that competence to do it, to develop a curriculum, a syllabus or whatnot, to even, you know what the assignment will be like or what that is a big challenge. And the CTL, we have tried to fill up this lacuna. We have tried to fill up this vacuum. And one way to do that is we organize workshops from departments to departments. And sometimes departments also invite us over during September, for example, when grad students are just coming in. We invite the CTL to please come and do a workshop about teaching. So we often do that, but that's not the only thing we do. We also often say that the CTL is just a couple of blocks away from you. You can always just walk in or send an email, and then we can support you grow your teacher identity and professional, you know, capabilities. That's one area. The other core area that grad students often have challenges with is framework. We realize that a lot of people tend to dissociate. A lot of people tend to separate the teacher from the framework that they bring to the classroom, e.g. their positionality. For example, the kind of lens that they want to use to teach. Somebody might even be a veteran teacher and they have been teaching for a while, but they are not able to use the kinds of framework that, you know, we are looking forward to as what academia needs. So at the CTL, we have specific modules, for example, on decolonization indigenization and, you know, anti-racism. We have those specific modules that we often ask grad students and postdocs to go through. And then we're also invited to workshops to walk them through these frameworks, because we have realized that academia is going farther away from the ideal, you know, that we all look forward to. And that is the university system or teaching system or higher education system that is able to help students to be critical thinkers. And at the CTL, we are very worried about that, but we are doing our best to fix it through our modules and through workshops. Those are two key areas that I think that grad students and postdocs have challenges with.
Thank you. It sounds like it's a very holistic approach to these two different challenges, but it sounds like they're intertwined, right? It's layers of identity, right? It's seeing oneself as a teacher and seeing oneself as an educator, and then understanding when you are an educator, what frameworks and what lenses you want to teach through, and understanding that your position as an individual, your position as a teacher, your position as a researcher factors into how those frameworks may or may not be delivered. And it sounds like encouraging a lot of reflective practice to getting folks to think about how they show up in a classroom and how they want to show up in a classroom. And you touched on some of the ways that tools and offerings that CTL is doing. But I wanted to ask Hebatala, what are some of the skills and competencies specifically that graduate students and postdocs can gain from participating in all these programs that Paul mentioned?
Sure. So you mean when they are participating in the workshops or the consultations?
Yes. Yeah. What are some things people could expect to learn and I guess skills they could say they've engaged with when they walk away from a session with the CTL?
Yeah, of course. One of the challenges that I mentioned before that was like the main driver to apply to be one of the EDAs is the lack of like formal training. So like what Paul said, you just sign a contract and then you don't know what to do next. And we have like that training program, and we invited everyone through the GradChat podcast to reach out to the to the CTL and follow up like the upcoming workshops and like sessions and courses, because you don't have to figure it all by your own. We are here for you. So, and also there is a myth that being a good teacher is something by nature, but I disagree with that, Cope, because even if you are not teacher by nature, you can learn how to be a great teacher. And one of the skills, I believe that like the exposure to a network of educators from different disciplines and different departments, and as well you will have like that level of expressing and reflecting about your experience. And I like that part in specific because it gives like opportunity to share your thoughts with other educators, especially when you have like difficult situation inside the classroom or you need to facilitate like inclusive classroom management, or like if you are struggling with course design and all these stuff. So by like joining like the workshops or attending like the micro teaching sessions or even like taking UTL modules on your own, then you will have like that sense of, okay, I'm doing like an actual training towards my ultimate goal to be a well-educated educator.
Oh, very nice. What I'm hearing is it sounds like some of the skills are education, maybe educational specific, but it's also the confidence that formal training gives people to try out new things in the classroom and then to reflect on those and adapt them as necessary. So it sounds multifaceted in the types of skills that people can take away from working with and partnering with the CTL. And I wanted to ask, we've been in a little bit more of kind of the program specific and kind of the overarching ideas that drive your work as EDAs. And I wanted to ask a little bit more of some more personal questions about your opinions on your work as EDAs. So Kim, what is your favorite EDA task? And Paul and Habitalo, please feel free to also share what your favorite task is as an educational development assistant.
Yeah, I was gonna say also, like, you know, not just me, because Paul and Habitalo I think also would have different favorite tasks, but my favorite tasks, sorry, my dog's barking in the background. My favorite tasks would be teaching observations is my first one. Unfortunately, we didn't have a lot of them this year. You know, every year it's different. And last year we had a bunch more, but this year, I guess just the word wasn't out as much. And then of course we had the strike. And so that, you know, effectively canceled 5 weeks of people's potential teaching observation time. But teaching observations, because I really enjoy watching people teach. I think it's also like, I just love going to different classes and like different, I don't know, departments and learning something new. And you know, last year I sat on like a civil engineering class and I learned about siphoning and like the mechanics of siphoning. So that was just really interesting. And I like watching, you know, students be really passionate about the work that they're interested in and, you know, bringing in theories into the classroom and talking about, you know, their research and what they're interested in. It's really, really great. So teaching observations, definitely my first one. And then I think my second, you know, really close is resource development, you know, figuring out what's missing for students, for teachers, for departments, for the university, and how can we fill that gap and how can we make something accessible to someone and how can we create a better pedagogical environment, you know, as Queens or as different universities. There are different CTLs out there. How can we best do that? And how can we best support students? So resource development would be my close second.
I guess I can go next. I have two favorite parts of my job as an EDA with CTL. One of them is workshops. I like going out for workshops. I really enjoy whenever King sent an email, "Hey, we have a workshop from English department." I'm like, yay! So yeah, and Kim is like, who is available to go? I'm like, count me in. I enjoy going out for workshops a lot. And that's because it gives me an opportunity to interact with people that are outside of my own comfort zone, my own space. Somebody in medical science, somebody in engineering, somebody, all of those other departments, you know, just like Kim said, it's just like the flip of it. Like, I enjoy going out to share ideas with them, especially given my work or given my experience or my qualification as a trained teacher. I often see it as a golden opportunity to bring pedagogy to these people, right? Especially because I do know that many of those people in those other departments might not have gone through that pedagogy training, right? So mm-hmm. I enjoy that part of the CTL work. And the second part that I really, really enjoy about CTL work is I like brainstorming and pitching ideas. Mm-hmm. And that's something that our leader, Carolyn McRae, that's something, you know, that she has given us the leeway to do. I really love that part of the work at the job, because we are always like thinking of problems and then the solution. We're always thinking of what is the problem? What are the problems that students or grad students and postdocs are having? What are the problems we are noticing on campus with respect to teaching and learning? So that part of always brainstorming on those problems and then pitching the ideas of how to solve them is something else we like a lot.
All right. So, wow. I don't know what to add after Kim and Paul, of course. I believe I have two favorite parts of being an EDA. So first of it, like facilitating workshops. And the second one is like one-to-one conversation with other graduate educators during the consultations. So there is something really inspiring about like creating a space where people can openly share their teaching experiences, the challenges, the successes, and even the uncertainties, even like during the consultations or during the open discussions and during the workshops. So I love like seeing those moments when someone realizes that like good teaching is not about like perfection. So then you have to be perfect teacher, but it's about being reflective and adaptable, and I could say like student-centered, whether it's a discussion about like inclusive practices or assessment design or simply how to handle tough classroom situation. I enjoy guiding those conversations, and of course I'm learning alongside from my peers, of course. So again, I feel like being an EDA, it's not just about like delivering content. So it's about like building confidence and fostering community and empowering other graduate students and postdocs to see themselves as educators. So that sense of impact, even like in a small moments, but during my experience as an EDA, there were like many moments where I felt that I could have an impact. So that's what makes this role so meaningful for me. Yeah.
Oh, it sounds like there are many favorite parts of being an EDA, and that folks who are interested in education should connect with the CTL early and often throughout their graduate careers, and perhaps consider applying to be an EDA themselves at one point in their graduate school journeys. Well, Kim, Paul, and Hebatala, it has been so great chatting with all of you, and thank you so much for doing the show today, and good luck with your work as EDAs and with all of your research as PhD candidates. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow, either from iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just type in Grad Chat in your search. Until next week, this is KM on the FM.
PFLAG Canada is there when it seems no one else is. Are you struggling with an LGBT issue? Every day, PFLAG Canada volunteers are contacted by frightened kids and by angry, fearful, or ashamed parents. PFLAG is Canada's only national organization that helps all Canadians who are struggling with issues of sexual orientation and gender identity. PFLAG Canada supports, educates, and provides resources 24/7. Visit pflycanada.ca.
You're listening to Kingston's only campus community radio station, broadcasting 24/7, 365 on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.
Today on Wings, a history lesson on bloated U.S. military spending. This analysis was given to women legislators from across the U.S. who came to confront their members of Congress in Washington, D.C. during Clinton's presidency. The budget numbers are bigger now, but the pattern's the same. Trump did not invent the cult of unlimited expenditures for weaponry, allegedly offset by cuts in public necessities, but really piling debt onto debt onto debt to benefit corporate elites. Trump is merely taking it to what may be the end of the line.
$7.5 billion every year in our federal budget goes to help U.S. arms merchants sell their weapons abroad.
One of the continuing fights we have in Congress is whether or not defense contracts are a kind of welfare.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. The Women Legislators Lobby, known as WILL, is a large group of women state legislators from across the United States. On September 27, 1999, WILL heard briefings on key issues. One speaker addressing the budget was Congresswoman Lynn Rivers, herself a former state legislator from Michigan.
I was elected to Congress in 1995. I came in with the Republican Revolution. And at the end of the first day, my husband had a bag of goodies that he had been given as a spouse of a member of Congress. He had Clinique facial products. He had a Betty Crocker chicken cookbook. And he had a 14-point guide to accessorizing. 1995, and we still believed that the member of Congress would be male, the spouse would be female, and she would be most interested in cooking and looking nice. Completely out of touch with the real world. I was appointed to the Budget Committee. Having come out of local government, having come out of state government, I felt like the priorities being expressed in the budget document of the United States of America didn't reflect real needs. The most prominent spending that we do as a nation is for defense. It is used either to buy weaponry, most likely weaponry, because we have a preference for spending on machinery as opposed to people. But it also goes for things like construction projects that are meant to support the defense apparatus, really to produce jobs in certain congressional districts. For several years, the F-22 was guarded zealously within the budget, and the money was there in the House budget. This year, the money was removed. Why? Because Newt Gingrich was gone, and the prime defender of that project no longer wielded power in Congress. The Senate, however, continues to support that particular airplane, and its funding likely will go on. Right now, I want to talk about tax cut. You've probably heard that the large tax cut bill has been vetoed. I believe it is quite likely that we will see negotiations go on between the White House and Congress that will ultimately create some sort of tax cut package. And I will tell you, when we do that, the situation is going to get worse because of fundamental untruths that have been perpetuated here in Washington and really are the foundation of this whole debate. The first one is that we have a balanced federal budget in this country. When both parties began claiming that the budget was balanced, they did it in a very misleading way. They took dollars in, dollars out, and said, since it matches, we've got a balanced budget. Social Security dollars, those dollars left over at the end of each month, between what's paid in FICA taxes and what goes out in Social Security benefits, were being used to argue that the federal budget was balanced. If those dollars were taken out of the mix, the federal government would find itself back in the red. very quickly. Even next year, we were projected to have a surplus, to have a balanced budget, and in fact, that money has already been spent. When we allocated $12 billion to fight the war in Kosovo, we spent any surplus that was projected to come on the future. So in fact, we've not had a balanced budget. Recently, we began to talk about the surplus and that there were dollars left over, and people said, this time it really is on budget. It's not Social Security. The problem is that those dollars have not yet materialized. They're projected. So the cuts we are talking about today, it's really like Wimpy saying to Popeye, I would gladly pay you on Tuesday for a hamburger today. That's what we're talking about. And we don't know if the dollars are going to arrive. As a matter of fact, there are some problems in the overall equation that suggest they may not. The idea of a surplus is predicated on two important issues. One, that the economy stays as strong as it is now, and knock wood, we all hope that's going to happen. But the second is that we're going to continue to pursue the balanced budget agreement, which was passed in 1997. And most people are aware that the balanced budget agreement put limits on the amount of spending that the federal government could do, but they are very unaware of what the balanced budget agreement is supposed to do in the next few years. We are struggling right now, having difficulty funding all kinds of programs that will be affected state and locally just by the caps as they are. But the projection of the surplus is predicated on the agreement in the balanced budget amendment that we will in fact cut spending from where it is today in order to produce the amount of money that is currently being projected as a surplus, on-budget surplus. Overall, discretionary spending will have to be cut 20%. It gets worse. That assumes that the defense budget will be cut to the same degree that everything else will. Those of us who watch this process know that it will not. If you do not cut defense, all other discretionary spending must be cut by 54%. Now, I don't think that's going to happen. But then we have a problem. Because if we give a tax cut today that we will happily pay for next Tuesday, and next Tuesday the cuts aren't made to produce the money, we are in fact going to be faced with either changing our spending again in a downward fashion or going back to the deficit spending that we did for the whole last decade. And some people say, well, that's fine, let's do deficit spending. Well, right now, 15% of the federal budget goes to servicing our $5.6 trillion debt. $250 billion a year to pay interest. That's not one penny on principal. If we can make progress on our long-term debt, those dollars can be freed up back into our general budget, back into our discretionary budget, and back into the programs that people rely upon. Probably most of you know that beginning in the middle of the next decade, we are going to have a significant problem in funding Social Security. Medicare is in much worse shape. We can't even figure out at this point how to fund the program that we already have, let alone expand on it. We have veterans who were promised benefits. We are now quietly but inexorably cutting back on those programs. We have brought children into this world who need to be educated. Our existing obligations are such that we must meet those first before we talk about tax cuts. And I'm like everybody else in the room. Every one of us would like to pay less in taxes. And as a politician, there is nothing that a politician would rather do than to be able to go into a room and say, I'm cutting your taxes. But I grew up in the Midwest. We're taught early on that you pay your bills, that you don't spend money until you have it in your hand. And this tax cut really is predicated on avoiding those two very real principles. And if we do not stop this kind of really shameless huckstering, we will find ourselves in tremendous problems
in the long run. And I think that we need to make sure that we bring the debate away from making changes in the tax situation and instead bring it home to making changes in our priorities within the budget. And I will tell you there is one way to do it. I truly believe that as more women serve at every level of government, the decisions that are made will be more humane. They will be more responsive to basic human needs. We are 52% of the population. We are the majority, a gentle majority, but the majority nevertheless, yet we serve in only 15% of offices nationwide. Why are we surprised that decisions don't reflect the views of most women?
Congresswoman Lynn Rivers, addressing the U.S. Women Legislators Lobby in September 1999. The president of WIL is Nan Grogan Arick, a state legislator from Georgia.
We have a total budget, folks, of $1.7 and a half trillion dollars. Talking about real money here. Those are the things we've committed as a nation to, that we're going to have a Social Security program, we're going to have Medicaid, we're going to have Medicare. You pull out of that, out of the total U.S. budget, the 34%, and that's the discretionary portion of the budget which Congress fights over every year. That's the hijinks and the monkey tricks that are going on right now. The Pentagon, community and regional development, transportation, education and training, employment and social services, the environment, science and agriculture, housing and income security, government administration and justice, health, international affairs. Those are the categories captured in the discretionary portion of the government. $591.5 billion. One half of the discretionary spending each year goes where? Does it go to health care?
No.
How about education?
No.
Oh, it's those welfare moms, I forgot.
No?
No, actually, that's less than 1%, I think. In fact, 50% of the budget, that's what we're looking at, discretionary programs only, up there what they're fighting about right now. 50% of that goes to Pentagon spending. $294 billion is what this year's Pentagon budget is coming in at. So while health care, education, housing, environment, and other human needs programs get small slivers, the military gets 50%. And you know what? President Clinton is proposing $112 billion increase over the next 6 years. Guess what? That's back up, folks, to the level of the Cold War spending. Working it back up. When we were told there was going to be great budget cuts in the wake of the Cold War ending, dollars that we were going to be able to address to the nation's needs. But by the year 2005, they'll be back up to where they were when the Cold War was raging. But we don't have a Cold War. And as the Congresswoman so eloquently told us, when you do that spending, it's offset by cuts in the domestic programs. And if you look a little closer at that pie, you'll see that we're spending 5% on health out of our discretionary spending. We're spending 3% on international affairs, 9% on education, training, employment, and social services. $50 billion for education, training, employment, social services, against almost $300 billion for the Pentagon. This bears looking into, doesn't it? So Congress's spending priorities are clear. They've put it right out there for the nation to know, and it's going to be our job to tell the nation. Weapons over job creation and assisting low-income Americans, war fighting over international diplomacy. The message to women, of course, if you're home with a welfare check, raising children, caring for them full-time, you're breaking the federal budget. Have you heard that till you're sick? That women on welfare and their children are breaking the federal budget? And we also hear that women who get out here and work are responsible for the fabric of American family life just going down the hill to nothing. Let's look a little further. Congress has proposed
as Lynn said, significant cuts in community and regional development programs, housing, support for small and minority business. You just keep going down the list. Summer jobs, they wonder why youth crime goes up when youth programs go down. It's a no-brainer. We could tell them. Head Start. They've never funded Head Start in this country. When President Clinton came in, Head Start was getting 25% of the eligible kids in this nation for Head Start were actually able to attend programs because we were only putting that many dollars in the Head Start program. A program proven to keep kids out of trouble, proven to make families more stable, proven to have for kids to have less intersection with this criminal justice system. And we're funding it at 25%. It's bumped up now into the 30s, but folks, it'll be on the chopping block. When you go and spend, get you up over $300 billion for the Pentagon, those programs are gonna take the hit. And we got this idea in Georgia. We started going through budget cuts in the early 90s, and Lord, everybody that's trying to provide services and keep the women's shelters open, and we're turning away folks for substance abuse programs, we're turning away folks, women that need shelter from a battering, violent spouse, don't have enough room for those. And people are coming to the legislators, help us, they cut our program. They took the scoliosis screening program out of the Human Resources Department. Help us, we need to get our money back in. And I turned around and I said, you know what, these groups really don't even understand that the cuts are starting up there in Washington and that the money's going to build the next fighter system. We're gonna look at those in a minute. I'm gonna stop preaching, I'm gonna get you some more hard information. But we brought people together in Georgia and said, here's where the money's going. Did you know what a B-2 bomber cost? Obscene amounts of money, and it goes up every year, and yet we can't run a scoliosis testing programs for kids in Georgia. And all the folks that are out here working in the trenches every day, delivering services, aiding constituents through their faith community and their professional roles or through volunteer organizations, need to understand until we set this country on the right road with a military budget that reflects the true needs of the nation, not what all the defense contractors and their paid-off folks in Congress want. Only then will we be able to address our budgets at the state level. And that's why women legislators is who we went to organize, because women get it. And women are going to take the truth to Congress. We're going to take it to our legislatures. We're introducing balanced budget amendments demanding that the military spending be decreased and that it be put over to secure the true security of our American people, and that is for housing, for jobs, well-educated, fully employed, productive citizens, raising families that'll be there for the next generation to do this. But you know what you hear from the boys? Oh, Lord, put a letter in the paper, and they go to hollering when you start talking about the cost of the plane. No, we need them. These people would have us, we'd be run over if we didn't spend this money. But I'll tell you what, if you want to take the size of the military budget for all the military spending that Sudan does, that Libya does, that Iran does, that Iraq does, that North Korea does, and that mean little old Cuba, they spend this much combined on the military. The seven, quote, rogue nations, all seven of them, the U.S. bar graph is as tall as this screen in comparison. That's the bloatedness. So folks, it ain't about securing our national defense. It's about lining pockets. Yes. That's what it's about. And where's the money going? Is it going into military pay? Is it going to our service people's families? 12,000 military families are on food stamps. Two-thirds of military housing are substandard. Military personnel routinely work two jobs to make ends meet and have a family member working too. My nephew and his wife, you know, just pulled away from the Navy finally, but it was scrape and scrape, because the money hadn't been going for the troops that they left to hoist the flag over. We're doing this for our troops. Money's going in the defense contractors' pockets. There's a long list of exotic weapons, fighter planes to bombers to submarines to helicopters. I mean, we would be here all day if we decided to look at their total weaponry and their exotic weapon systems. But let's just, Lynn, you mentioned the old F-22. Lord, remember down in Georgia when they rolled that bad boy out? Honey, they had lasers, and they had cheerleaders, and they had marching bands, and they ever had it on cable TV, and they had Newt Gingrich up there, that this is what America's all about, and this is what we need to make us strong. How much does it cost? $35 million a plane originally. The cost has soared. It's up at $200 million per plane. How many do they want to build? 339.
How many crashed?
$64 billion for the $64 billion for the program. And you know what? Only 14% of the required hours of flight tests have even been completed, and they haven't been satisfactory. Do we need it? No. The job of the F-22 was to defend against the Soviet fighter aircraft. They never did get built. You know, there's been a little problem over there with the Soviet Union. It doesn't exist anymore. And our present F-15 Eagle, the quote, in their words, finest fighter plane in the world, has now been sold to other countries. And they use that as a reason that they now need an F-22. There's a game here. They know what they're doing. So when you boil it all down, we underwrite with our tax dollars that ought to be going to fix up the schoolhouses in this country. We underwrite all of this enormously expensive, bloated, disgustingly outrageous, unregulated, unsupervised, unscrutinized, and unaccounted for spending on military systems. I want that way. And you know who we're in a budget race with? You know who we're in an arms race with? This bloated budget? Ourselves. Our dollars versus our dollars. Because we underwrite with tax dollars all the development of these systems, and then it winds around, next thing you know, they're over there at the Paris Air Show, and dang, these things are so sexy, while Lord, Saudi Arabia wants to buy some. And you know, there's money to be made off of selling this stuff. Who makes it? The defense contractors. Big budget bandit. Arms race with ourselves. Let's look at our nuclear weapons. While the Cold War's been over for 10 years, there are more than 36,000 nuclear weapons in the world today. And we are spending $5.5 trillion of taxpayer money for nuclear weapons which pollute the earth and pose enormous danger and threat, almost beyond our ability to comprehend. In the nuclear club, we're at the top of the list. We spend $35 billion every year for that privilege of being at the top of the list. $35 billion. But we can't increase teacher salaries, can we? Good Lord. 5,000 nuclear weapons are ready to launch in minutes. That's our super overrated, overblown, overheated super readiness, that we can kick off 5,000 nuclear weapons in a minute. Can you imagine them kicking off 5,000 kids going to Harvard? It's not going to happen until we get in there and start running it. It's not going to happen until our message is heard. And you know, this is what's so outrageous. We represent the mainstream. 77% of the American people believe the world would be safer without nuclear weapons. 61 retired admirals and generals are calling for nuclear disarmament. 34 Nobel laureates advocate nuclear abolition. But this nuclear weapons bandit is on the loose, blowing our tax dollars and stealing it from our children. Star Wars. They were smart when they named it, weren't they? Were they smart? Are they marketing? $120 billion of taxpayer money has been spent since 1960 on the Reagan Star Wars plan, which had another name before he came along. Space-based weapons, protective shield. Never going to work. We're told that by many, many experts who dare to speak the truth. But this multi-billion dollar system, even if it worked like a crackerjack, wouldn't be any defense against the likely sources of future attacks, low-flying cruise missiles or car bombs, terrorist things on the ground. A Star Wars shield up in the heavens isn't going to do a thing about that. But we're blowing the money on it. $10.5 billion over the next 6 years, $180 billion over the next 30 years. And this one, and a lot of us didn't know about this one until WAND and other peace organizations came up with these figures. $7.5 billion every year in our federal budget goes to help U.S. arms merchants sell their weapons abroad. That'd provide a head start for 500,000 kids. Build 424 new schools, fund 50,000 new teachers. They're up there now batting down Clinton's plan to add 100,000 teachers. $7.5 billion of taxpayer money. We have 6,000 government employees whose full-time jobs is to help arms dealers sell U.S. weapons abroad. I mean, we're over in the area of ludicrous, ridiculous, and unbelievable, are we not? And then we underwrite loans from countries that can't afford to buy the weapons, and those are loans that somehow we don't have any problem at all eating. We're happy to do that. Now, if it were rice and beans for somebody, Lord, no, they're going to have to pay for that. We've got to get our priorities straight. We've got to end the arms sales subsidies, forget Star Wars, abolish nuclear weapons, and cancel the F-22 for starters. The top military experts said we can decrease the budget by $40 to $100 billion a year. And I want to look and talk for just a minute. Let's look at our vision of what a budget would look like. What we would do if we're writing the budget for our communities, our children. How do we slice it differently? Here's the story. Prenatal care, extension of prenatal care, fundamental. Janet Reno told us 4 years ago when she spoke to us on violence that the first thing to do about violence in our society is to fully fund top-notch prenatal care. That was a woman. That's right. Health coverage for every American child. Those two would be $12.3 billion. Look what we could do over 142,000 affordable housing units. Expand WIC, the program for eggs and cheese and milk for pregnant moms and their newborn kids and their toddlers. We're not fully funding WIC. Is that a joke? We're not fully funding WIC. $24.3 billion to repair or replace one-tenth of the dilapidated school buildings. Head Start for all eligible children, 50,000 new teachers, double the job training and the education for welfare to work recipients, $48 billion cut from the Pentagon budget would buy us those things. Just a small shift in what we're spending over from the military side, the domestic side, and we would still be the strongest military power in the world. We wouldn't lose sleep at night about that. But we would be a much stronger nation internally because we would have a population better fed, better housed, better educated, better employed. That's the true security. And finally, you've heard how we support women to go to Congress, we support women's state legislators, and just finally a fact, when we looked at the voting record of the women that we'd supported to put in the U.S. Congress, they voted on education, on children, on women's issues, on the environment, on peace, on health. They voted right. They voted our priorities 91% of the time. Women overall in Congress voted 73% of the time for our priorities. The men were down at 49%. No question. 65 of 535 people up there are female. The women take the hit on welfare, on home heating, nursing home subsidies. Every single area where they're cutting disparately impacts women. We have the most at stake. We must find our voices and take them and magnify them. We need more women at every level advocating and speaking out. Margaret Mead said, never doubt a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. And you know, we're not so small. We are the mainstream. We are the majority. It is our vision that should be directing the spending of our tax dollars. Join us to take that message to Congress tomorrow.
Nan Grogan Orrick, a state legislator from Georgia and president of the Women Legislators Lobby, briefing the members of WIL in Washington, D.C., September 27, 1999. The percentage of women in U.S. state legislatures is at a new high in 2025, 33.5%. Women also reached their highest ever numbers in the U.S. Senate, 26 out of 100. In the House, women members are nearly 30%, but four women members are not allowed to vote, including the representative from Washington, D.C. Special thanks to Mal Johnson, Frankie Hutton, and Suzette Cullen, and to Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, a Feminist Criticism of Exchange. Wing's sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Hello and welcome to Salt Licht in Rapture. I'm your host, Nishan Tung. Salt Licht in Rapture is a sonic exploration of, to quote Virginia Woolf, violent waves of emotion. Featuring both known and lesser-known musicians and poets, A special emphasis is placed on oddball, enigmatic, outsider artists whose work invokes dreamscapes and feelings of alienation, nostalgia, melancholy, existential unease, and yearning. Join me on Fridays at 8 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Broadcasting 24/7, 365, you're listening to 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca, Kingston's only campus community radio station. Tune in for the best local programming.